With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard.
Ronaldinho! Oh, the first Kopfballmöglichkeit for Ronaldo. Zidane, vorbei. Zwei Klasse gemacht von Zidane. Zidane. Und das ist kein Abseits. Das ist das 1-0 für Frankreich durch Thierry Henry.
Joining myself, Marcus Speller, and Jonathan Wilson today is Tom Williams, a contributor to Bleacher Report, ESPN, The Independent, and many others, and the author of Do You Speak Football? Tom, lovely to have you with us.
Thank you, Marcus. Lovely to be here.
We are travelling back to the 2006 World Cup quarter-final between Brazil and France today. Tom, why have you chosen this game?
So the thinking behind choosing this game was that it gives us an opportunity to talk about Zinedine Zidane. Mm-hmm. This was arguably his finest performance in a France shirt, coming right towards the end of his career. We saw Zidane at his sinewy, balletic, elegant best. And there was occasionally a criticism of Zidane. I think this is perhaps more after his career than while it was ongoing, that he would decorate games without ever really running them. And this game, he bosses from start to finish, from his first touch of the ball to the final whistle. In so doing, ends the World Cup careers of some of the most decorated Brazilian footballers of recent times. A chance to wax lyrical about Zidane, which is always a pleasure, to talk about the unexpected blossoming of that France team, and also to talk about Brazil and the fact that, you know, they went into that tournament thinking they were going to be able to just blow everyone away as they had done 4 years previously. And partly as a consequence of what happened in 2006, they've never really been the same team since. There's quite a lot to unpick, hopefully.
Mm. I mean, yeah, the game was, you know, two heavyweights of international football, certainly in recent times. Brazil were, I think they were on an 11-game winning streak in World Cup matches. France ended that. I mean, Jonathan, you will obviously remember the game. What did you think when these two sides were drawn against each other?
Well, I mean, they had a great history of playing against each other in World Cups. Mm. I mean, one of the games that I really remember from my childhood, one of the games that really made me love the World Cup was that quarterfinal in 1986, which finished 1-1. Michel Platini missed a penalty on his birthday, and then the game goes to penalties. Carlos should have been sent off, and Brazil goalkeeper. And was sort of, oh no, he Schumachered them again. And France ended up winning on penalties. And, you know, the penalty hits the post and comes back, hits Carlos in the back of the head and goes in. At the time, I despised Carlos. And then I was doing my goalkeeper's book. I, I wanted to interview him because I did a chapter on Brazilian keepers. So I'd spoken to Valdir Perez. I tried to get Taffarel and failed. Spoken played for São Paulo in 92, Zetchi. And then I was around at Zetchi's goalkeeping school to speak to him. And who should be there having a cup of tea, having claimed he was out of the state, but Carlos. And I did, this is not what we came here to talk about. But, I ended up, he sort of grudgingly agreed to give me 2 minutes. And we had like an hour's chat. And it's one of the best interviews I've ever, I mean, he was essentially talking at me. But him just going through the neuroses of being a goalkeeper and how he really wanted to be an architect because he was quite good at football. All his friends and his parents made him be a footballer, but he really dreamed of being an architect.
Yeah.
And he was like, this fascinating figure. And then, of course...
you should have said to him after the interview, you should have said, that was a really good interview. You're good at these. You shouldn't be so quick to dismiss him.
And then, of course, 98 final and all the controversy over Ronaldo and everything. And I guess that that final wasn't the game that made Zidane, but his two goals in that final maybe lend a gloss to that tournament for him that wasn't entirely deserved, given he missed a huge chunk of it after being sent off in the group stage. And it was another part of that sequence of enormous France-Brazil games.
Yeah, so they played each other recently. France, obviously, World Cup winners in 98. Brazil were the World Cup champions in 2002. And you had a big old Ronaldo up front who'd been scoring the goal. I mean, the names in those two sides, they're just real off the tongue, don't they? It's just phenomenal players each side boasted.
Yeah, and you look at that Brazil team in particular, and all the build-up to that tournament was about the magic square, that front four of Kaká, Ronaldinho, Ronaldo and Adriano, that they went into the tournament with those four up front, and all the Joga Bonito Nike ad campaign around it. And you can sometimes forget quite how feared they were and what a sort of archetypal Brazil team it seemed. And it seemed entirely natural that Brazil should go to a tournament and stick their most creative players, their most dangerous attacking players, all of them in the starting 11, and then also be able to call upon Robinho off the bench and Juninho Pernambucano off the bench. And yeah, this incredible galaxy of Brazilian talent. And I think in many ways that the last sort of classically Brazilian team in some ways that we've seen at a World Cup, because I think one of the consequences of this game was that Brazil sort of lurched so far in the opposite direction that the team that you saw under Dunga at 2010 was a very disappointing, quite attritional team. The 2014 team, very dependent on Neymar. And then obviously lose him to injury and don't recover and succumb to that catastrophic thrashing by Germany. And then even the team that went to the last World Cup, which is probably the most coherent Brazil team of recent years, didn't really get you on the edge of your seat. But you went into the 2006 World Cup thinking, this is a proper Brazil team. I mean, like, look at the players they've got in their lineup. And on the other side of the halfway line, a France team that is sleepwalking through its qualification campaign until Zidane and Lilian Thuram and Claude Makélélé reverse their decisions to retire from international football, come back into the fold, get France over the line. Zidane, who's announced on the eve of the tournament that he's going to retire from football at the end of it, so he's playing out this swan song. You've got Franck Ribéry playing his first major tournament off the back of his first season at Marseille. You've got Patrick Vieira, you've got Thierry Henry up front as well. Talent on both sides. But I think it's important to remember the extent to which Brazil were seen as the favourites before the game because of that incredible collection of attacking talent they had.
Yeah, and the way they performed at the World Cup as well. As you say, they were scoring a lot of goals. They'd brushed everyone aside. Okay, they weren't massively tested. Well, you could argue against Croatia, actually, in the first game. Maybe
they struggled
times.
Against Croatia.
They did a little.
They beat Australia 2-0 pretty comfortably, beat Japan 4-1 even more comfortably. And then that Ghana last 16 game, which... Well, I'm not sure how serious a game that was on the Ghanaian side, shall we say.
I see. And that's as far as we'll go there. But the French side, they struggled, as you mentioned earlier, Tom. They coughed and spluttered their way through the group. They were, they'd gone out in the first round in 2002. People were concerned. There was the noises coming out from the French camp weren't great. And Ramon Domenech is a funny figure to say the least. So when they were drawn against Brazil, you thought to yourself, surely Brazil will go on here, because there were still many people's favourites to reach the final and win the cup.
Yeah, I mean, France had been very underwhelming. 0-0 draw against Switzerland in their opener, a 1-1 draw against South Korea in their second game. Zidane is then suspended for the third game against Togo, and they managed to win that, goals from Vieira and Henri, and they sort of limped their way into the knockout rounds. Zidane's been playing so badly that the question is asked whether he even deserves to be recalled for the last 16 game against Spain. And then suddenly things click against Spain unexpectedly. France go behind to a David Villa penalty. Then Ribéry equalises just before half-time. And then after quite a cagey second half, France finally get in front, a header from Vieira. And then Zidane scores this fantastic goal. Having kind of grown into the game himself, he's sent free down the left-hand side in stoppage time. There's acres of space because Spain are pushing up in search of an equaliser. He cuts inside Carlos Puyol and he puts a shot into the bottom left corner. Wrong footsy Gicasius. And it was a very unexpected performance from France to throw the shackles off that successfully. And you look at the Spain team as well. I mean, Casillas, Ramos, Puyol, Fabregas, Xabi Alonso, Xavi, and then front three of David Villa, Raul and Fernando Torres. So that was very much the spine of the team that would go on to dominate world football over the next few years. So, you know, no pushovers. And in that match, France find this ability to play effective tournament football. Zidane looks like he's getting back to his best. And so, find themselves in the quarterfinals, perhaps a little bit unexpectedly, given how poor they'd been in the group phase. But very much second favourites against this galaxy of Brazil players.
Mm. So the game gets underway.
Well, I think the selection from Brazil is interesting. As you said, the talk before the tournament had all been about this magic quadrilateral, the two forwards with the two number 10s behind them. Well, he didn't play that in this game. It was sort of a midfield diamond with Gilberto Silva at the back. They had been playing Emerson, the Roma midfielder. But I don't know if he got injured, but Gilberto Silva ends up being the deep-lying midfielder with Zé Roberto on one side, Juninho Pernambucano on the other, and then Kaká behind Ronaldinho and Ronaldo. Mm. So no place for Adriano, no place for Rubinho. And I guess Ronaldinho ends up, although it sort of was that classic Brazilian 4-2-2-2, when he was playing deeper, Ronaldinho was able to play wider to move out to the left. Here he was very much the second striker alongside Ronaldo. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if going to that diamond made them quite narrow. And that, given the way France played with Sagnol and Abidal linking up with Ribéry and Malouda, whether that tactically, in retrospect, was a mistake.
Mm. The game started reasonable pace, actually, and it was quite cagey. There wasn't too many clear-cut chances, but Brazil perhaps slightly more on the front foot in the early stages.
Really struggled with the French offside trap, though.
They did.
Watching it back, I was amazed by how many offsides there were. It was almost like they never played against a team with a remotely disciplined offside trap before. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, Dominic gets a lot of criticism, but credit to him for sorting that out, because, you know, they were incredibly well organised to catch Brazil like that. And, you know, it's a huge risk. I know Ronaldo wasn't perhaps as quick as he had been sort of 7-8 years earlier, but he's still quick.
He's still Ronaldo.
There's one offside call like about midway through the first half, and it's Juan, the centre-back, who gets on the end of a free kick, I think, or a ball from deep, mm-hmm. and tries the most sort of impossible attempt at scoring, like a flying back heel from about 12 yards out, puts it over the bar, and he's offside, so it wouldn't have counted. But yeah.
He was happy to see the flag, though, I think, after that one.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So it was, as I say, quite cagey, very tight defensively, not too much created. And as you were watching the game, Tom, I mean, it looked, you know, looking back on the highlights, it did look like they were almost cancelling each other out, these two sides.
Yeah, it did. I mean, I think, I remember even before the game, I was very keen to see how Zidane would play. Having seen those sort of flickers against Spain, and obviously all the talk in the build-up is about the rematch of the 98 final when Zidane's two goals give France the title at Brazil's expense. And so I wanted to see whether he could pick up where he'd left off against Spain. He gets his first touch of the ball after about 30 seconds. He's facing his own goal just inside the France half. I think it's Zé Roberto and Juninho, two of Brazil's centre mids, who close in on him. And he backheels the ball towards Brazil's goal, spins, throws a step over that beats Gilberto Silva, moves into a bit of space, tries to clip a pass over the top to Thierry Henry and just slightly overhits it. And I think Henry's offside anyway. But Zidane is on his game, like right from the start. And again, I mean, I'm sure that we've all had idle moments when you're sort of, you know, scooting around on YouTube and you find yourself watching those little 5 minute highlight clips of this game, you know, Zidane's best moments. And I think that's, you know, one of the really striking things. And I've watched quite a lot of footage of Zidane in that game to prepare for this. And he's almost faultless, like the whole game through, and very successfully sets the tempo. And you make the point about how well set up France were defensively and, you know, how solid the offside trap was. And I think that was ultimately one of the key elements in this game, was that whereas Carlos Alberto Pereira, the Brazil coach, configures his team to crowbar in all these attacking players, albeit in this instance with Adriano on the bench to give them a bit more ballast in midfield, the only players with any real freedom in this France team are Zidane and perhaps to a slightly lesser extent Henry. The two wide attacking players, Ribéry on the right, Malouda on the left, have both got an important defensive brief.
In a sense, their work rate, their reliability allows Zidane a bit of freedom, because you know that worst case scenario, you're going to get the two banks of four, and obviously Makélélé and Vieira are as solid as you like at the back of midfield. So if you have those two wide players dropping in as well, Zidane and Henry can effectively do what they want.
Yeah, and it's almost as if it's almost as if Dominic is saying, not that, you know, Dominic was any great tactical mastermind, but it's saying if you want to indulge players in the team at this level, you need to have this amount of sort of defensive apparatus around them. You need to have two proper holding midfielders, Vieira, Makélélé, you know, arguably the two best players in their position at that time, certainly two of the best holding midfielders of the last 10, 15 years. Two wide players full of energy who are happy to drop back and defend, and then a pretty well, you know, experienced back four. And that's what gave Zidane the platform to rove around the pitch, to set the tempo, to speed things up, to slow things down. Whereas with Brazil, you've got, as Jonathan says, this untested 4-4-2 diamond, 4-3-1-2, if you like, they've not really used before. Ronaldinho playing out of position, and a very disjointed feel about the team. Whereas one thing you could say about France is that you know, everyone knew what they were doing. And I think that's one of the reasons perhaps why we do find this slightly cagey opening to the game, because France are very solid but aren't committing too many men forward. Brazil have got all these forward players on the pitch but can't really bring them into the game.
And they're really reliant on Roberto Carlos and Cafu for width. And, you know, the best in the world, they're both in the autumns of their careers. Mm. Are they really going to have the fitness to get up and down on a hot afternoon for 90 minutes when you've got your Ribéry and Malouda, two of the more energetic French players, up against them?
But also, you get the impression, particularly with Carlos, that even though he is clearly, you know, past his best and has lost more than a yard of pace, he's not prepared to accept that. And there's one point in the first half where he gives Willy Sagnol, no slouch in the French right-back position, a sort of 5 yard head start, and still just tries to knock the ball past him on the outside and get round him. Obviously Sagnol gets back in time, slides in to block the cross, actually plays the ball against Carlos, and it goes behind for what should have been a goal kick. It's given as a Brazil corner, but again a sign that perhaps Brazil, and certainly that the fullbacks, hadn't realised the extent to which they were a little bit off the pace.
Well, if we're ready to move on to the goal, that sort of leads me quite neatly there. Again, watching it back, so obviously France get the free kick out wide, and Zidane delivers a cross right to the back post, and Thierry Henry delightfully volleys home from close range.
I wouldn't bother marking him.
Yeah,
what's Henry ever done in the box?
Honestly, Jonathan, I was watching it back. The marking, you have...
You can't even tell who's meant to be marking. Well, he's so in so much space.
Well, if you pause the footage, as Zidane is kicking the ball, you have five French players who go attack it, and three Brazilians follow them. It's remarkable.
But the rest are all in a line,
yes,
on the edge of the penalty area.
And I'm pretty sure it's Roberto Carlos.
It is.
Yeah. Who... Now, I know we can maybe unfairly criticise Roberto Carlos' defending capabilities. Clearly, he was a good defender in his day. But on this occasion, he is at the back post. I think he's meant to be on Henry, which is probably a bad decision, although Henry not noted for his heading ability, but still didn't need to head it. You know, you're that close and it falls to your foot. But Carlos looks like he is sort of bent over, catching his breath, and then just watches the ball and watches this happen. I wonder if he was so knackered, he was just taking a breather. And, of course, it's not the time to do it when Zidane's whipping the ball in and they score
Henry's
the only goal.
What, the 4 or 5 yards out in the end?
It is.
Uncontested side for
and,
volley.
And Carlos yeah. doesn't, there's not even, he doesn't even react
yeah.
to the free kick being taken.
He watches
he's
it like he's a
spectator.
He's got
his hands on his knees, yeah. maybe he's adjusting his socks. The ball comes in and he literally doesn't move mm. between Zidane striking the ball and Henry volleying it into yeah. the roof of the net. He's in the same position as the players wheel off to celebrate.
It is
remarkable.
For, but it is remarkable because if you think about how cagey the tie was and how tight it was at yeah. the back for such a lapse, you know, those kind of games you think, oh, it's going to be a moment of madness or a moment of brilliance. Well, I suppose it was sort of both, really, because it's a good delivery and a lovely finish, but my goodness, you know, they were given the freedom of the stadium to do it in.
It looks like the sort of goal you might expect a team to score when they're already 3 or 4 goals to mm. the good, which is what makes Brazil's attitude in that situation so confusing, you know, Carlos in particular, and also because it had been a game of so few chances.
Yeah.
And they're not really, I'm not sure they'd even been a proper shot on target up to that point. So it was absolutely on a knife edge. Mm-hmm. And then half of the whole Brazil team switches off and they're a goal behind.
Yeah, well, they're the margins, aren't they? I mean, the statistic was that it was the first time, perhaps the only time, Zidane and Henry had combined. I think Zidane set up Henri for
it was yeah
the
first time he'd ever set up Henri for a goal, which is pretty
yeah,
remarkable.
And what a time to do it, and it was the only goal of the game. And then the rest of the game, you know, substitutions were made. Adriano and Robinho come on for Brazil, but they just can't force a way through because France stayed so stern. I mean, did you think when you watching that game, you think, oh, hang on a minute, right? They're up against it now. We'll see what Brazil are made of. And it turned out it just wasn't enough because France were pretty tight at the back.
Yeah, and even more than that, France initially create the better chances.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a few moments after that. Franck Ribéry gets the ball out on the left, turns away from his man, plays a low cross into the box that Juan almost slices into his own net. And there are a few other incursions into Brazilian territory where France look quite threatening.
Well,
and at the other end of the pitch, it's almost
from,
nothing.
Zidane sort of beat 2 or 3 men, slides the ball through for, I think it's Vieira breaking through from the back
and
of the field.
Down.
Yeah. And Juan hacks him down. And, you know, I think a yellow probably was right, but it could have been red. I mean, Juan ended up having a bit of a nightmare. Even after that first sort of 10 minutes after the goal, in that sort of last 10, 15 minutes, although Brazil, as you'd expect, dominated possession, it was still France who actually looked the more dangerous and probably should have won it more comfortably.
Zidane, Mallorca, Ronaldo ausgespielt.
Were you surprised by this verdict today?
I'm very surprised to see this verdict to come on me because I was not expecting that.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
When I came, they told me something else, and I'm coming. You got an interview there, so it's a big surprise anyway.
How was Dominic considered at the time in France?
I mean, he's mainly known in France as the man who's sort of one of the architects of Lyon's rise into Ligue 1 under the stewardship of Jean-Michel Aulas. And I mean, it's his first international tournament as well. And there's a, you know, you tend to think about Domenech now, and he is seen as this slightly clownish figure. And that's very much how he's still seen in France today, albeit as someone who still does a fair amount of punditry and has, you know, occasional columns in L'Équipe and things like that. But I think at this stage, there was a lot of optimism about the sort of manager he might go on to become. I mean, clearly, the qualification campaign had not been, you know, up to standard. There was a narrative that emerged subsequent to the tournament that the players had sort of taken control, that this football that we saw against Spain and against Brazil and perhaps to a slightly lesser extent against Portugal and Italy was the product of the players deciding, no, we're gonna sort things out here. But actually, the makeup of the team doesn't really change. It's not like the players are suddenly banging on the door and insisting that you know, certain players are picked. The team doesn't really evolve a great deal from the start of that tournament to the end. So yeah, so at this point of his career, Domenech is not yet the figure of fun that he was.
Because the first time I had any dealing with him, you know, I'd sort of heard these stories, and, you know, I knew the qualification campaign hadn't gone well, and there'd been a lot of criticism of him. But there was a lot of me thought sort of was, yeah, but French press always criticised the France manager. You know, they criticised Aimé Jacquet in 1998. That's just what they do. But I was sort of, before that semi-final against Portugal, which is the first time I'd seen France live in that tournament, I'd been sort of, oh, I'm quite interested to see what happens if this guy, suppose he picks his teams by horoscopes and whatever. And Portugal were on first, so it was Scolari, and I can't remember who the player was. And Scolari was at his most grumpy. They refused to do any questions that weren't in Portuguese. You know, it's a World Cup semi-final. Yeah, if you look around this room, there's about 500 journalists in this room. Maybe 100 speak Portuguese. You know, you have to do this in French at least, because that's who they're playing. Ideally, English as well. You're in German. You might be polite to do it in German. Mm. This was before the days of FIFA simultaneous translation. So we all just sat there for like an hour or whatever, half an hour, watching Scolari and whoever the Portugal player was, speaking a language we didn't understand, taking questions in a language we didn't understand. Domenech comes in. They're happy to do it in whatever language you want. He goes out, and I think it was Galas was up next. And then after about 5 minutes of Galas speaking, suddenly you see this sock, or a hand like over a sock, like a sock puppet, pokes up above the desk and starts kind of, you know, answering the questions. Like not saying anything, just sort of, yeah. And Galas, if it was Galas, whoever the player was, starts absolutely pissing themselves laughing. And then Domenech kind of sheepishly puts his head up.
What a lad.
And you sort
what
of thought,
a lad.
He's so much nicer than Scolari. I'm massively behind Domenech now. Whatever the French have said about him, he's not as just cussed and unhelpful as Scolari.
And this is before the game.
This is the day before the game, yeah.
And didn't he write a book, Domenech? Lonely at the Top, am I right in saying?
Yes, yeah, he did. Yeah, I've not read it.
Yeah.
But I'm sure it's
on
a
your to-do list.
If his press conference record, if his sort of post-match TV interview record is anything to go by, it's probably worth the...
My goodness. So, I mean, but you're right in saying what you said at the start about this game belonging to Zidane. And it was this game was... When people think of Zidane, they think of a number of things. But actually, this game is one of the things people that leaps to mind and people often talk about. Yeah, OK, these two goals in the 98 World Cup. And they may mention the sending off, which sadly, the sending off in the World Cup final, we forget that he actually penenkered a penalty in a World Cup final. Which only just came off, of course, as it hit the bar and then just went over the line. Incredibly brave or stupid thing to do, depending on how you look at it. But this game, do you think this is pretty much where Zidane's legacy lies in this particular match?
Yeah, I think to a certain extent. I think if it's not for this World Cup run, it's not for this particular performance against Brazil, I don't think his legacy would be anything like, you know, what it now is as a player. You look at his achievements with France... You know, 98, obviously he's the symbol of the victory in many ways. His two goals against Brazil that decide the final, it's his face that's projected onto the Arc de Triomphe. He went into the tournament as France's star player, as the standard bearer of this generation. But actually, as Jonathan was saying earlier, didn't have a great tournament, needed a big performance in the final in order to sort of salvage his tournament, which he got. Euro 2000 is absolutely brilliant. Mm-hmm. Probably his most successful, most complete tournament on an individual level.
Yeah, definitely.
But then 2002 is a massive letdown. He's injured, comes back too quickly. France go out early. Euro 2004, France lose to Greece in the quarterfinals, and flickers from Zidane. Of course, that there's two late goals against England in the group phase, in stoppage time and in the opening group game. But then with Real Madrid as well. I mean, it's 4 years since that incredible goal against Bayer Leverkusen in Glasgow that wins the European Cup for Real Madrid. It's 3 years since he's won anything with Real Madrid, and by his own admission, the two previous seasons that preceded the World Cup, he was nowhere near his best, and there was a feeling that he was looking a bit washed up. That, you know, it was time to go. That this was the right time for him to bow out. And you know, his performances in the group stage in the first two matches before he picked up the suspension gave no indication that this was to follow. And I think that's what was so exciting, to see him burst to life in the second half of the Spain game and then just produce this, you know, performance for the ages against Brazil. And I think, you know, and obviously that sets the platform for him to then go on and be the key figure in both the semi-final and the final for France. And I think without that Brazil game, I don't think Zidane would sit quite as high in the pantheon of the greats as he does.
Mm. And also, on turning to Brazil, as Tom said earlier, it kind of knocked the stuffing out of them a bit in terms of the World Cup. They'd won 09, 02, 06. It was a disappointing end. 2010, you know, drill sergeant Dunga tries to do his stuff and it doesn't quite work. 2014, we know what happened there, losing to Germany 7-1 in the semi-final. And then the World Cup in Russia, okay, they were beaten by a good Belgian side and so on, but that Brazil side there, interesting to see, had they have won, maybe Dunga didn't come in and say, right, I'll show you how to do it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think appointing Dunga was a conscious effort to recreate 94, yeah. Bringing Scolari was an effort to recreate 2002. And, you know, I think when you then think of 2014 and just how dependent they became on Neymar, almost not just in terms of technical ability, but in terms of star power. If you drop Neymar into that team, I mean, A, does he get in the team? And B, he's competing with Ronaldo, Ronaldinho, Kaká, Robinho, Adriano. You know, the pressure's never going to be on him in the way it is now. So I don't know if that's something that's happened with Brazilian youth production. I don't know if it's just, you know, the way they set teams up now. But yeah, I think you're right. I think that is the last Brazil where, even though, I mean, I was conscious even at the time, it wasn't as exciting as the teams of 82 and 86. But it's a lot more exciting than the Brazil teams you see now. And then, you know, the great thing with Zidane producing that sort of iconic performance is that it is then followed two games later by, you know, the most self-destructive. And that self-destructiveness has a sort of heroism about it because it came so close to such a great performance. You know, there was the sense of, this is still one of the greats. Whereas I think you're right, if he hadn't had the Spain game to an extent, but particularly that game, then it would just be, what's this old man doing, getting himself sent off? Whereas it was, oh, what's this legend doing, getting himself sent off? And, you know, there's Ed Smith in his book, What Sport Tells About Life, has this theory, which I think he's taking it, you know, the ideas of Ernest Becker, who developed Freud's ideas. And Becker had this idea that because the ego is sort of essentially, it's randomly constituted, we have no control over our coming into being. And what really brings that home to us is the fact we have no control over our going out of being, that the dissolution of the ego is beyond our control. But if you can somehow seize control of that, if you can commit suicide effectively in the pursuit of your ideals. So I think this is what I wrote my master's dissertation on. on Conrad. So you have Lord Jim in the novel Lord Jim, who dreams of being this great heroic sailor. And then when he's very young, his act of cowardice, he jumps off a ship, which he wrongly believes is sinking. And of course you should never abandon ship. And so he's haunted by this. So, you know, he sets himself up then to be the most courageous. You know, he enacts his duty absolutely, and he ends up in charge of some kind of, I can't remember where it is, but some tribal village somewhere, and leading them in this hopeless charge and being killed in the war. But he's leading the charge, so he's killed himself in the pursuit of his ideals. Zidane effectively takes control of a dissolution of his own ego by getting himself sent off while standing up for whatever values, well, we don't quite know what Matarazzi said to him, but defending the honour of his family, defending the honour of his team. Now, it might just be that, you know, the occasion got to him and, you know, Matarazzi worked out the right buttons to press. But whether it's true or not, it's a sort of beautiful end to the Zidane story. And to be sent off in your first World Cup match and in your last one, it's a nice sort of completion of the circle.
And
it would have been better if he won the World Cup again, of course.
Well, but he left us with that image, Tom, of him walking past the World Cup trophy. I mean, oh my goodness, you know, just what an anti-hero. You see the Zidane 10 on his back and off he goes, and he doesn't even give the trophy a look.
I mean, I remember watching that game in a restaurant near Covent Garden, which was full of Italian. It was Italian,
in central
actually,
London.
So you'd expect, in central London, but sort of supporting France. And when the headbutt happens, watching on TV, everyone's just completely confused because the TV cameras don't pick it up. The player's stopped, the referee's talking to the fourth official, you're not entirely sure what's happened, the players are all sort of looking at each other, there's a lot of talk going on, you don't know what's happened, and then you see the replay.
Yeah.
And it's just, you cannot believe it. And there's a fantastic bit of French TV commentary, Thierry Gilardi, the late Thierry Gilardi, who was commentating the game on TF1, which is the main French TV channel that all French people would have been watching. And he just cannot believe it. And it's, oh no, Zinedine. Oh no, what have you done? Why have you done this? Not now, not today, not after everything you've done. And that sense of disbelief. And I remember feeling the exact same thing. And, you know, sometimes something controversial happens in a game and you see the replay, you think, oh, we might get a red there.
Yeah.
And when you saw the replay, it was like, that is it. Zidane is off. That's how this story finishes.
Yeah.
Italy going to win the World Cup.
Well, the only doubt was exactly what had been seen. And we had a long interview with Horacio Elizondo, the Argentinian referee, in Blizzard. And there's all kinds of stories that he was told, you know, the fourth official had seen it on TV. And Elizondo denies that completely. He says...
Well, there's a bit of a conspiracy around that one.
Yeah, well...
Gigi Buffon, if you watch Buffon during the melee, he's very...
Well, what Elizondo says is the fourth official told him on the mic that Zidane's just headbutted Matarazzi, you've got to send him off.
Took a long time to say that, though.
And... according to Elizondo, there's no way he could have seen the TV monitor because the TV monitor was slightly down the tunnel. So there's no way the fourth official could have seen it. And I kind of actually, when I thought about it, I think I believe him because how do he know to look at the TV? It wasn't like he had the TV in front of him.
Yeah, okay.
The TV was behind him, so he would have had to go back and, you know, you can see he doesn't.
Yeah, that would have been obvious. Yeah.
And so what Elizondo does is he realises he can't just walk up to Zidane and show him a red card because this is going to create chaos because nobody's expecting anything.
Oh, I see.
So that's why he goes over to a linesman to have a chat to the linesman so that people realise something's going off here. And he goes over to the linesman and just says, yeah, keep focus, you know, good game, it's fine. And then goes over to Zidane, by which time everybody's worked out there's something odd just happened. Why is Matarazzi on the ground? Why is Zidane looking a bit guilty? Ah, okay. And then, of course, by then everybody has seen the TV replays. Presumably people have started texting people in the crowd. And so, you know, it's not that massive shock, but it would be if he had just turned around and shown Zidane the red card.
Yeah, when you describe it like that, the calm the referee has to show in that moment is quite extraordinary, really. But it was a red card. That we can all agree. and an incredible end to Zidane's career. But that game, though, Tom, it was great to reminisce about that game because... The guile, the balance, the skill, the technical ability, just the way he commanded that game was something else. It really was.
I mean, you talk about elite sports people being in the zone, and I think for that entire 90 minutes, Zidane is in the zone. And he always played with that sort of languid gracefulness. But I think in this game, it reaches an absolute peak. And as I was saying, it starts with about 30 seconds on the clock when he takes Brazil's entire midfield out of the game in the space of about three touches. And then throughout the game, you know, it's almost as if he's taking it in turn to show up every star name in the Brazil team. He flicks the ball over Ronaldinho. He flicks the ball over Ronaldo. There's a roulette. Of course, there's a roulette. It's Zinedine Zidane on Gilberto Silva in the second half. And, he, you know, that the longer the game goes on and the more desperate Brazil get, the more he seems to grow into his role as playmaker. And I think in many ways, I was watching the game back last night, and David Pleat describes it as one of the finest displays of what I'd called old-fashioned inside forward play that you're ever likely to see. And that's exactly what it was. And
it is old-fashioned because, and this struck me watching it back, they're not pressing, not in the way we understand pressing now.
Yeah.
This is football just before the pressing revolution.
Yeah, and it's amazing actually how, I wouldn't say that the game looks dated necessarily, but you know, you watch it back now, you know, 13 years on, and the pace of the game is completely different. You know, that lots, you know, there's much less tactical coordination. You know, there's no sort of patient building the ball out from the back, you know, as a routine at every goal kick, at every free kick in the defensive third. So it does feel like a bit of a throwback, and I think again, bringing things back to Zidane, he's unfortunate slightly in that he was perhaps the last true great to come along before Ronaldo and Messi, who've suddenly taken the game back to the 1940s, 50s stats wise. And you know, you look at Zidane's stats, and they don't stack up against Ronaldo's and Messi's. I mean, whose stats could certainly the sort of player he was, the position he played. But I think if you take that Brazil game and you watch it in its entirety and you see what he did, I mean, I think there could not be a more eloquent testament to his greatness as a footballer, and he produces it at exactly the right moment.
That was the greatest games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. We're back next week with another classic game, so don't miss it.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.